Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're delighted this morning to have with us Judge Myers Cuff of the Central District of Illinois. We are happy to be sharing these cases with her. Our first case for argument this morning is Bland against Hardy. Ms. Myers. Johannes, I'm sorry. Oh, dear. Not doing well.
May it please the Court. I represent Keith Bland, and I'll be taking all your questions this morning. I'll be reading them on the screen to make sure I have everything. Keith Bland was convicted at a trial of murder and robbery without any physical evidence connecting him to the crime, without any eyewitness testimony, without any accomplice testimony, without any stolen goods being recovered from him, without any weapon being recovered from anyone, and without any confession. He was convicted of going to a house for the purpose of getting a gun when one of his alleged accomplices shot and killed the victim with one of the stolen guns. The errors in this case were serious and had a substantial effect on the verdict, and I want to focus your attention first on two of them. One, that the state knowingly used Mr. Bland's mistaken testimony in violation of Nepew v. Illinois. Two, that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to object to the routine use of a stun belt. Time permitting, I'll go on to discuss two more errors: the police detective's repeated references to Mr. Bland's refusal to answer his questions, and appellate counsel's failure to raise the stun belt issue on direct appeal. First, Nepew. Mr. Bland testified that his gun had been taken from him several months before the incident. That was a mistake, and all he did was get the date wrong. So he was asked about the date of arrest, and it was incorrect. The state knew that, and the state at no point has ever tried to dispute that the prosecutor knew that the arrest date was mistaken. But that did not stop her from incorporating that information into her closing argument. She did that because it fit her theory of the case, which was that Mr. Bland did not have a gun and committed the crime in order to steal one. Her theory was that Mr. Bland did not have a gun. And now she had Mr. Bland admitting a key fact that established that. And she no longer had to rely only on Patrick Scott to give the jury a reason why Mr. Bland would go to the home and commit this crime. So what did she do? She argued to the jury, "It's real interesting that Mr. Bland told you that he didn't need a gun that day. He said his gun had been taken from him several months before. Did he have a gun that day? Obviously not." And from that, the jury was supposed to infer, well, how did it know he obviously did not have a gun? From the fact that it was taken from him several months before. Nepew says that the state can't use mistaken testimony. Here the state used that testimony. The state doesn't really argue that it was not use. They do argue that it's okay to use mistaken testimony if the defense introduced it. But that's not a tenable distinction. Nepew is about the role of the prosecutor in the search for truth, and the prosecutor's role as an agent of truth. And when the prosecutor urges the jury to base its verdict on something she knows isn't true, she goes completely against that.
What decision of the Supreme Court says that a prosecutor cannot use a defendant's incorrect statement against him?
That is an application of the Nepew rule, which says that the prosecutor can't.
What decision of the Supreme Court holds that a prosecutor cannot use a defendant's incorrect statement against him? Cases like Napoue deal with statements by third parties rather than a litigant, right? And under the AEDPA, you need clearly established law by the Supreme Court. So I'm asking, what decision of the Supreme Court applies this rule to statements by defendants?
There is no decision that is factually on all fours. However,
normally we say in the legal system that a statement by an opposing litigant is an admission and is actually binding on the opposing litigant. I mean, that's a pretty fundamental premise of the legal system.
Well, Your Honor, this is about the role of the prosecutor. And the prosecutor, in a modified adversarial system, has a duty not just as a one-sided advocate for conviction, but also to serve as an agent in the search for truth.
That's pretty general. That's why I'm asking, what decision of the Supreme Court says prosecutors can't pounce on statements by the defendant? It's not simply that it's an admission. It's the defendant is free to try to take it back if he wants. I mean, your client never tried to take it back.
And that's and we're not contending that the prosecutor had a duty to help the defendant. What her duty was to not take affirmative advantage of it.
Was she required to remain silent about this testimony then, in your view?
Was the prosecutor required to remain silent?
If she didn't have a duty to correct it, did she have a duty to just stay silent about it?
She had a duty not to suggest to the jury that it was true.
Yep, but I'm just puzzled why. In criminal cases, prosecutors know or strongly believe that a lot of things the defendants say are false. That's why they're being prosecuted. Defendants often commit perjury on the stand. Your argument seems to be that if the prosecutor thinks that a defendant's statement is perjured, the prosecutor is, as a matter of constitutional law, disabled from trying to take advantage of it. That's a huge category, huge set of the defendant's actual statements in most criminal cases.
The category isn't that large, Your Honor. You said believes and thinks. Not that many facts are as cut and dried as an arrest date. And that was the fact here. And there's no dispute that the prosecutor actually did know the correct arrest date.
So did the jury, right? Yeah. Because the prosecutor admitted the arrest record into evidence, right?
When the prosecutor referred to it, she said that it was not for the jury, and there's no indication that the jury ever saw it and no contention that the jury ever saw it.
But it was in evidence?
There was a discussion on the record of perhaps she was going to show it to the trial judge, but there's no indication that the jury ever saw it, and the prosecutor said it was not for the jury. So
how would this apply to an alibi? The defendant gets on the stand and gives a cock and bull story as an alibi, and the prosecutor's got very powerful documentary evidence that the defendant wasn't where he said he was. Is the prosecutor disabled from trying to make hay of this obviously false alibi because the prosecutor is absolutely sure that it's false?
No, because to do that would serve the search for truth. And when a prosecutor impeaches it.
We're now getting subtle. So the prosecutor can take advantage of the defendant's false testimony when that's a good idea, but not when that's a bad idea.
It's not clear
how we make this operational.
Well, it's not about whether it's a good or bad idea, but again, it's about the fact that the prosecutor is not just a one-sided advocate, but also has a duty to ensure the truth. I mean, for example, the defense has no duty to turn over inculpatory evidence to the prosecution, but the prosecution has a duty to the defense. And so, that was an error. Why was that important? And it was important for two reasons. And the first reason that was important, like I already said, the motive. It fit into the state's theory that Mr. Bland did not have a gun that day, needed one, and needed to commit the crime to steal one. The second reason that was important goes to Mr. Bland's credibility. The prosecutor said at least twice in her closing argument that either everybody else in this case is a liar or Keith Bland is a liar. She said he was, quote, not credible, and that he was, quote, impeached in every material way. But just a couple minutes before she said that, she had told the jury that it was real interesting.
I don't see how that argument helps your case, that you would have the prosecutor impeach him in one more way instead.
It's that she did so by urging the jury to believe something that she knew was not true.
Well, it's perfectly normal, though, for counsel to urge that anything helpful from the other side is believable, while things that were hurtful are not. That happens in every kind of case. Let me ask you a little bit more about the motive theory. I believe you said in your opening comments that the victim was murdered with her own gun. Is that clear, or is it, was it just a gun of the same caliber?
The forensic evidence was that it was a gun of the same caliber. But
not necessarily the same gun. It's relevant because of the state court's treatment of this issue, where, if you'll recall, the analysis was, even if the statement had been corrected, that would have put a .38 caliber handgun in the defendant's possession prior to the time of the murder, and the victim was murdered with a .38 caliber handgun.
And the important thing to look at, though, is how the evidence fit into the way the prosecution argued the case, and how the prosecution's theory was that Mr. Bland needed a gun, went to the house to get it.
I thought the theory was that all the defendants needed guns. They all needed protection from hot sauce.
The prosecution related its entire version of the facts, which included all three men, but focused on Mr. Bland. And Patrick Scott's testimony was about Mr. Bland's. The alleged conversation was when Mr. Bland brought up his need for protection and the others chimed in. I'd like to talk for a couple of minutes about another serious error that was in this case, and that is the stun belt and trial counsel's failure to object to it. The state can't restrain a defendant absent a particularized justification. Trial counsel did not know that, which is why he didn't object, and that's why we're here arguing about ineffective assistance. The ineffectiveness claim is before this court. It has not been defaulted for reasons we explain in our briefs.
The reason you give in your brief is that you think it's a good claim and therefore it can't have been defaulted. Well, that's not relevant to default. How was this issue presented to the state courts?
The issue was presented first in the direct appeal brief, and then it's reached on the merits in the appellate court's opinion, and then it was in, and then Mr. Bland's petition for leave to appeal cribbed extensively from his counsel's appellate brief. So, first of all, the fact that the appellate court addressed the decision on the merits.
I'm a little confused. Are we talking about the PCR appeal or the direct appeal?
When we're talking about the stun belt, we're talking about the post-conviction appeal. I'm sorry if I misspoke.
Okay.
And so the appellate court on the post-conviction appeal addressed the stun belt issue, the ineffectiveness issue, on the merits. So under Malone, that tells us that the state court saw it, and that's okay, and that's good enough. Also, since the language was the same between the PLA and the appellate court brief, essentially what the state's asking is to assume that the Illinois Supreme Court would have missed something the appellate court saw. So the issue is before this court. And there's no dispute that it was deficient not to object. The state court and the state agree. So the Sunbelt issue is Strickland prejudice. Might the verdict have been different if trial counsel had objected? And it would have been different. To see why it would have been different, start at the moment trial counsel would have objected. First thing that would have happened is the stun belt would have come off because there was no reason to keep it on. No indication that Mr. Bland was threatening to escape, that Mr. Bland was threatening to disrupt the courtroom. And that's the essential state interest that a stun belt and other courtroom restraints are about. That was missing here. So the stun belt comes off. The state court opinion. State court said that even if the jury could see the bulge, it would not have known the bulge was a stun belt. That can be set aside. It's not entitled to deference because it's based on an unreasonable determination of the evidence before the state court. The evidence before the state court was Mr. Bland's allegations taken as true. He said that it bulged out from under his shirt. He said it was an enormous bulge, and when this case was before the state court, that was to be taken as true. The state court simply assumed that there was no way a juror could have figured out that the bulk.
A different way of addressing that same point is simply to say that there was no evidence before the state court, as there was, say, in the Stevenson case, that jurors actually saw it and knew what it was.
However, in Stevenson, there had been full development of the facts. Here, the evidence before the court was Mr. Bland's allegations taken as true. There has never been full development of the facts.
Right, but he didn't allege the jurors saw it. He didn't allege the jurors knew what it was. He didn't have any such evidence. Isn't that part of the investigation of a PCR?
At this stage of the case, it wasn't, because the case was dismissed before the facts were developed. At the stage of this case, Mr. Bland's allegations would...
Another way of approaching that would be to say that you've got to come forward with some evidence of possible prejudice. You've got to investigate before you bring the claim.
Well, Mr. Bland's ability to investigate from a jail cell proceeding pro se was very limited. That's why the rules, post-conviction proceedings, provide that a pro se petitioner, if he alleges a winning claim, as Mr. Bland has done here, and needs to establish facts to prove that, is appointed counsel to facilitate discovery. And I'll be happy to answer any additional questions on this during my rebuttal time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Blankenheim.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General Michael Blankenheim on behalf of the respondent, Marcus Hardy. This Court should deny petitioner's habeas claim that he's entitled to relief under Nepeu versus Illinois because there's no clearly established Supreme Court precedent that extends Nepeu to the novel factual circumstances of this case. Though it's clearly established the prosecutors cannot knowingly use false evidence, no case has extended that rule or has defined the knowing use of false evidence to encompass what the prosecutor did in this case.
Could the prosecutor use a confession that she knows is false to pursue a conviction?
Nepeu does not speak to that question.
Oh, I'm asking, what do you think?
Well, if she knows that it's false, there would be at least an ethical issue about whether it would be proper to use that evidence.
Or a due process issue in terms of convicting somebody with a false confession?
Yes. But clearly established Supreme Court precedent focuses on, the Nepeu line of cases focus on a particular kind of breakdown in the adversarial process, where a prosecutor has knowingly injected false evidence into the case and the defense is unable to counter that claim, either because the evidence has been suppressed or because it's not otherwise available to the defense. And as a result, the jury is not able to fairly assess either a witness's credibility or a component of the state's case. And that wasn't the case here.
So in your view, the district court was wrong on this issue?
As to the contrary to analysis, that's right. And again, petitioner was in the position to correct the false evidence. Trial counsel introduced the fact of his conviction for the gun charge, knowing that the state would use that conviction for impeachment purposes, which it ultimately did. And so with defense counsel able to counteract the prosecutor's argument and to correct the petitioner's false testimony, this case is clearly distinguishable from Nepeu. And to go to your question, Judge, about whether the conviction was before the jury, the conviction was presented to the judge but did not go back to the jury during deliberations. That was presented only for the impeachment purposes. Petitioner argues that the false evidence was used to undermine his credibility, but the prosecution presented 7 witnesses who contradicted petitioner's testimony, including 3 members of his family, 2 police officers, Patrick Scott, and Victor McClendon. And even if this court were to find that the state court contradicted or unreasonably applied Nepeu in this case, any error, the state court reasonably determined an alternative holding that any error was harmless, and the same result would obtain under Brecht.
Counsel, going back a minute, are you saying that the conviction was not given to the jury or told to the jury?
The conviction was not admitted into evidence for purposes of, it was presented only for impeachment purposes. The trial judge instructed the jury, and this is at page 611 of the trial transcript, that they could consider defendant's prior conviction for impeachment purposes.
And were they told what the conviction was?
Not by the trial judge. They were told by defense counsel, who brought that out during the petitioner's direct examination testimony, that I was arrested for possessing this gun. I pleaded guilty.
To follow up, the position is that the paper record showing the correct date never went to the jury.
That's correct.
Okay.
And so while the jury did not learn the correct arrest date, they did hear petitioner's testimony that he possessed the gun at the time of the murder, which gave the jury a basis to assess the defense claim that he had no motive to participate in the case. Turning now to the stun belt issue and the issue of procedural default, we've conceded that the ineffective assistance of trial and appellate counsel claims were fairly presented at the state appellate court level, but not at the state Supreme Court level. The state appellate court adjudicated those claims on the merits, and under this court's decision in Malone, we have no basis, or once the state court has adjudicated a claim on the merits, the federal court has no cause to engage in the typical fair presentment test.
If I recall correctly, the petition for leave to appeal was docket 29, Exhibit O, that you all submitted, correct?
That's correct.
And that document has repeated references to ineffective assistance of trial counsel by failing to object. Why was that not sufficient to present that issue to the Supreme Court?
It appears from the petitioner's pleading that those claims were argued only in passing just to underscore the gravity of the trial
passing.
Court.
It's all over the document.
Well, our position is that those references only go to underscore the error that the trial court committed in forcing the petitioner to wear a stun belt, pointing out that there was no strategic basis for choosing for allowing the stun belt as opposed to some other restraining device.
Right. So are you saying that there have to be separate Roman numerals for the substantive claim and for the ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
No.
Okay. What's insufficient about Exhibit O to alert the Supreme Court to the idea that there's a claim that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to object?
The focus of the pleading was on the freestanding stun belt issue.
Would you agree that the document repeatedly mentions ineffective assistance of counsel on that issue?
Yes. So if we present that argument to the district court and the district court agreed with us, this court disagrees, I'll turn to the merits of the ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim. To establish prejudice, petitioner needs to show that there was a reasonable probability that had an objection been made, that the objection would have been sustained, and also that there would have been a reasonable probability that had that objection been sustained, petitioner would have been acquitted in the absence of those stun belts. Petitioner cannot make the showing on either prongs, but particularly on the reasonable probability of a different result. The evidence in this case was overwhelming. The testimony of Patrick Scott regarding the conception of the conspiracy to rob the Bland house, the preparations, and the aftermath was corroborated by a number of prosecution witnesses. Most importantly, his testimony that he heard petitioner and the co-defendants discussing that they had taken a 12-gauge shotgun and two handguns from the Bland home was consistent with the evidence at the crime scene, where petitioner's father's four guns in the bedroom, three were stolen, the 12-gauge and the two handguns underneath the pillow. The only gun that was remaining was the Beretta, which had been recently moved underneath a dresser. The clear inference is that petitioner, who had been kicked out of the home I believe in 1999, more than a year before the crime, would not have known where to look for that gun. Patrick Scott's testimony about the guns is also consistent with Victor McClendon's testimony. He testified that in early September of 2000, shortly after the murder, petitioner and Ian Lockhart, the co-defendant, tried to sell him a shotgun and handguns. Patrick Scott also heard testimony that the co-defendants planned visits to the Bland home and for the purpose of asking about family members' schedules. That testimony was corroborated by petitioner's half-brother and step-brother, both of whom testified that petitioner was at the Bland home on the day before the murder asking about schedules. Patrick Scott also heard that petitioner and Ian Lockhart proposed alibis for themselves, and the petitioner's alibi was, I was with Christopher Scott, the co-defendant, playing basketball. That was the precise alibi that petitioner gave to two detectives, Detective Guilfoyle and Investigator Hunter. So for that reason, because petitioner cannot show that there was a reasonable probability of a different result, he cannot show Strickland prejudice to excuse the default for his freestanding stun belt claim. Turning to the issue about the stun belt's visibility or the juror's awareness of it, the evidence before the state court during post-conviction proceedings established only that the belt was worn under petitioner's, concealed under petitioner's shirt, that it bulged out, and petitioner's allegation that he knew that the jury could see that bulge. There was no evidence presented showing that the jury was aware that the bulge under petitioner's shirt was a stun belt. And in the end,
does he have to develop that evidence while he's in prison?
He has to present some evidence to corroborate the petition's allegations or explain its absence. And that's Illinois law. You can find that in People v. Galtney, which is cited in our brief, and also People v. Jones in the petitioner's opening brief. And contrary to petitioner's position, it would not have been impossible to obtain the kind of evidence needed to establish juror awareness of the stun belt. For example, he could have obtained a letter or some form of affidavit from his trial counsel regarding the visibility of the belt to the jurors and the kinds of conclusions the jurors might have drawn from that. Given that that evidence wasn't presented, and it was not unreasonable for the state court to hold that petitioner cannot show that the belt had been visible. And indeed, this court reached a similar conclusion in the Stevenson case, where it recognized that a stun belt concealed under the petitioner's shirt does not necessarily establish awareness, or excuse me, the concealed stun belt is ambiguous, and the purpose of the device is not readily apparent. Finally, I would just like to address petitioner's claim. We have presented an argument that if the court finds that habeas relief is warranted on the stun belt claim, that this court, the writ should be limited to a retrospective hearing regarding the propriety of the restraints. Petitioner argues that we forfeited that argument, but that's not correct. This court has said that a forfeiture occurs when there's a failure to raise an argument in a timely fashion, and it's true we did not raise that claim in the district court, but that should not preclude us from raising it here, given that the district court did not even reach the merits of the stun belt claim, let alone the question regarding the appropriate relief. If this court has no further questions, we ask that you affirm the district court's judgment. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And Mr. Johannes, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as to your client.